From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, UFOs, ETs, and alien abductions. But here's what's happening. Speaking of abductions, in Cleveland, authorities there have charged the owner of a home where three women were found after a decade in captivity with kidnapping and rape, but will not charge his brothers. Ariel Castro, a 52-year-old former school bus driver, waived his rights and has been cooperating with investigators since his arrest. He is charged with three counts of rape and four counts of kidnapping. Castro was arrested Monday along with his brothers, Pedro Castro, 54, and O'Neill Castro, 50 years old. Police found no evidence linking to the two brothers to the disappearance of Amanda Berry, Michelle Knight, and Gina DeJesus. Cleveland's police chief, as we suspected, said the three women were held captive in the Ohio house for about a decade. They were restrained with ropes and chains. And a year after Amanda Berry disappeared in Cleveland, her mother appeared on the Montel Williams show to speak to a psychic about what happened to her daughter. Psychic Sylvia Brown, whom I booted off this program many years ago, who has made a career of televised psychic readings, told Luana Miller on a 2004 episode of the show that her daughter was dead, causing Miller to break down in tears on the show's set. "She's not alive, honey," Brown told Miller on the show, according to the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper. "Your daughter's not the kind who wouldn't call." Miller told the newspaper that she believed 98% in what Brown had told her. Miller died a year later from heart failure. And, of course, this isn't the first time that Sylvia Brown has been wrong. She also said that Sean Hornbeck from Missouri in 2002 was kidnapped and dead. Sean Hornbeck was found alive in 2007 and is with his family now and doing well. In 2006, she was on Coast to Coast as we talked about those Virginia miners who were trapped. And Sylvia suggested that they would be found alive. All but one found dead. There you have it. San Francisco city leaders, after losing a key round in court against the cell phone industry, have agreed to revoke an ordinance that would have been the first in the United States to require retailers to warn consumers about potentially dangerous radiation levels. William Thomas, of course, the award-winning journalist with us, let's check in with him now on this story. Give me your reaction, Bill, to this.
George, this is really tragic. You know, this is another victory for the forces of denial and a $1 trillion wireless lobby. The question, George, is at whose expense? You know, well, revoking this right to know law, you know, obviously means that people in San Francisco and around the United States do not have a right to know how dangerous wireless devices are. And I find this particularly disturbing when we're talking about children and pregnant women. I mean, after all, 2 years ago, the WHO classified this kind of microwave and RF radiation as a class 2B potential carcinogen. So really, what's the issue here? This has been out in the public for a while.
The fact that the courts would kind of negate this, William, what does that tell you about what will happen around the rest of the country?
Well, it's happening here in Canada. I can tell you around smart meters and in the United States as well. Same radiation, George, as cell phones, same dangers. We're losing lawsuits right and left. Why? Because statute law is rigged against us. It's arrayed against us. And we're using common law up here in Canada with great effect.
All right, William, thanks for that update. Appreciate that. The health benefits of exposing skin to sunlight may far outweigh the risk of developing skin cancer, according to scientists. Research suggests that sunlight helps reduce blood pressure, cutting heart attack and stroke risks, and even prolonging life. UV rays were found to release a compound that lowers blood pressure. Huge numbers of people on Earth are keen to leave the planet forever and seek a new life homesteading on Mars. About 78,000 people have applied to become Red Planet colonists with the not-for-profit organization Mars One since its application process opened on April 22nd. Mars One aims to land four people on the Red Planet in 2023 as the vanguard of a permanent colony. with more astronauts arriving every 2 years thereafter. Robert Zubrin, of course, the head of the Mars Society. Robert, I don't know if I'd be one of those to want to volunteer and stay there forever. What about you?
Well, if I thought it were possible, I'd be willing to do it. I mean, you know, we're all on a one-way trip somewhere.
Yeah, well, that's true, too. But you got to give these people credit. 78,000 people applying for four slots to do this. This is pretty gutsy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it says something. I mean, look, it says that people want to do something important with their life, something that's going to matter for the future. And to be the first colonist on a new world, that would matter. And, of course, it's only four to start. The plan of Mars One is to follow that up with continual missions. This is not a suicide mission. This is a colonization mission.
Will some of them come back, or are they going to just stay in these little pods that I'm going to have you talk about in just a second?
No, this is Plymouth Rock. This is one way. This is what the pilgrims did when they came to America. It wasn't a round trip. We're going to have discussion of this mission and also the Inspiration Mars mission, which is going to be a round trip mission that's being pushed by Dennis Tito at the Mars Society Conference in August in Boulder. So we're going to have the proponents of these missions actually come and speak. Tito's coming, and I think we'll have Mars One coming as well.
Robert, I've got to ask you about this. They're going to live in these pod-type home environments. Can you explain them, and how do they get around to go from one to the other?
Well, when you go outside, you'd go in a spacesuit. You either walk or you could ride in a vehicle. But, the habitats will be kind of like the Mars Desert Research Station that we run in the desert in Utah. It's about 27 feet in diameter and 16 feet tall with two decks. So it's got about 1,000 square feet of floor space. And then you could have a bunch of them and have tunnels between them. So you could go from one house to another without going into a spacesuit. But then when you want to go outside and explore and do work, you put on a spacesuit. And there'll be greenhouses as well to grow plants, and that's additional habitable space.
Gosh, I just don't know, for the rest of your life, you'd be in these little pods.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, a lot of people in New York live in apartment buildings, and they go into the subway, and so they're pretty much living inside all the time, too.
All right, Robert, thanks so much, and good luck at your conference. We'll be talking with you before that, I'm sure. Mass extinction. You know, it's happened before. Can it happen again? We're going to check in with Annalee Newitz in just a moment and find out if it can. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast Day Out. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. You know, in its 4.5 billion year history, life on Earth has been almost erased at least a half a dozen times, shattered by asteroid impacts, entombed in ice, smothered by methane, torn apart by powerful mega volcanoes. What happens if it happens again? Can we survive? The Work, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction by Annalee Newitz. Annalee, of course, is the founding editor of the science website io9.com and a journalist with a decade's experience in writing about science, culture, and the future for such publications as Wired, Popular Science, and The Washington Post. She's the editor of the anthology, She's Such a Geek, Women Write About Science, Technology, and Other Geeky Stuff, and was a Knight Science Journalism Fellow at MIT. Annalee, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, George.
Well, you know, we saw this meteor become a meteorite over Russia a few months ago, and we have talked on this show for years, decades, that, you know, there's always that possibility we're going to get wiped out again. Tell me a little bit about your work, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember.
So basically, the book is about how humans will actually survive one of these mass extinction events. And as you mentioned before, there have been five mass extinctions on Earth already in its long history. And we may be entering a new mass extinction. There's some evidence to suggest that may be happening now. And so the question is, you know, how will we respond to it? And it really depends on what the danger is, what the threat, you know, what's causing the extinction. So it could be something like a meteorite. Certainly that's caused mass extinctions before, which is a very terrifying, although cinematic prospect, makes for a good film. but actually what's interesting is in my research, what I found was that most of the mass extinctions that have happened already were ultimately caused by climate changes.
You know,
they would start with some terrifying sort of, Hollywood movie disaster, like a giant volcano or like a giant rock smashing into the earth. But really, those kinds of disasters are kind of local disasters. You know, they kill a bunch of creatures in the near sort of zone. But what really causes the mass extinction is when these kinds of disasters unleash toxic particles into the environment and just kind of smother the planet.
Now, these mass extinctions happened over what kind of a time period? Were any humans involved at that time? Probably not.
No, humans have never been through a mass extinction. And the most recent mass extinction is the famous one that killed off the dinosaurs about 65 million years ago. And that did involve an asteroid impact, as well as giant volcanoes that were going off in India. And there's now evidence that kind of the 1-2 punch of the volcanoes and the asteroid impact probably helped wipe out most of the dinosaurs.
So all of those extinctions, one could honestly say, they weren't caused by man at all. Man wasn't around. He didn't do it.
No.
At this point now, the mass extinctions of the future, could you say that they're caused by man or, once again, all Mother Nature?
So at this point, it's really hard to say because mass extinctions we could experience a terrifying event like a megavolcano. There's actually a megavolcano under Yellowstone Park right now. So
the caldera.
The caldera. Wow. So, you know, visit the park now while it's still intact.
Well, and you know what? In some areas, the ground does get heated up, doesn't it?
It does. And actually, the ground has been rising over the past few years, and which also causes concern. So there's the possibility that you'd have some kind of cataclysmic event like that, or we could be bombarded by gamma rays from a nearby supernova. Things like that do happen. But then, as I said, you know, climate change is responsible ultimately for most of these mass extinctions. And so the question is, will humans pump enough carbon and other toxins into the environment to change the environment enough to set off one of these mass extinctions? And you have to remember, a mass extinction, it really is a mass extinction. What it means is more than 75% of all species on the planet die out. So it's not just humans dying out. It's us plus 75% of all species, animals, fish, plants, sometimes even insects, although insects seem to survive better than everyone else. And usually a mass extinction takes place over about a million years. So they're not something that you can see happen instantly. It takes a long time for all those species to die.
It's a slow build. And the reason why I brought up the question to you about a mass extinction with humans is, you know, one of our guests, Michael Cremo, is a researcher. He's written several books, including Forbidden Archaeology. He believes that mankind could be hundreds of millions of years old. And if that were the case, then obviously they did fall into some of these extinctions as well. But who would know? I mean, the evidence that he cites, you know, one would have to dig down hundreds of feet, thousands of feet just to find some things.
Yeah, I'm pretty comfortable with the standard kind of evolutionary story that most anthropologists tend to agree on, which is that humans basically evolved about 100 to 200,000 years ago. And we have a lot of, you know, fossil evidence for that and evidence that there were previous species that evolved into humans before that. So I'm pretty satisfied with that account of events.
The caldera at Yellowstone generally blows every 600,000 years. People say this one's overdue.
Yeah.
This is dangerous because if that thing really goes and goes in a big way, you're talking about a planet-wide disaster, aren't you?
Absolutely. And I mean, again, what's going to happen is there's going to be a localized disaster. And when I say localized, I mean on the North American continent. But what's really going to be deadly is that this eruption will pump a ton of carbon and methane and other toxic gases into the atmosphere. And so over time, what you'll see is the planet may first go into a cold period, a small ice age, and then it'll heat up. And, you know, animals and plants just can't deal with those rapid changes in temperature. It's a recipe for death. But I'll tell you who can survive that stuff is humans, because we actually know how to build tools. We know how to find shelter. We actually understand why the temperature is changing, because we understand that the volcano has gone off. So that's one of the things that equips us to survive a mass extinction where a lot of other animals wouldn't.
Tell me what happened over 1,000 years ago in central Turkey, where people did build some underground areas, didn't they?
They did, yes. One of the places I visited when I was researching my book was an area in central Turkey, which is an underground city called Derinkuyu. And it's a city that was built about 1,000 years ago. And the people there were hiding from various invading armies that were represented different groups at different times. And they would tunnel under their homes deep underground. It was about 5 stories down. And it was a thriving city with thousands of people living there. And the reason why it's really interesting to me is that it's a great example of how people really can thrive in an underground city in the event of something like a megavolcano or a radiation disaster. Because, you know, if there is a radiation disaster, if there's a war, or if, like I said, we're hit by gamma rays from a supernova, which really could happen, we're going to need to get underground. You know, we're going to need to protect ourselves from the environment, and there's nothing like having a couple feet of rock between you and radiation or toxins to remain safe. So the fact that people 1,000 years ago were able to live pretty well under the ground, I think is another sign that humans, you know, were really quite ingenious at adapting to circumstances that are really quite terrifying to contemplate. But when it really comes down to it, we managed to invent ways to survive and even enjoy ourselves a little bit. One of the things they had at Derinkuyu was a winery, winemaking in the very lowest levels of the city. So they were, having a good time, a little bit of a good time.
Tell me how the little girl, Anna Lee Newitz, got interested in science and subjects like this.
Oh, wow. I was always interested in science, but it probably started with dinosaurs and outer space. Those are usually the two things that suck kids in, and I certainly did get sucked in by that. I always wanted to go to space or to hang out with dinosaurs, preferably both. So, that was the beginning of it. And, of course, that immediately gets you interested in kind of world-ending events, because a lot of crazy explosions happen in space, and one of those is responsible for killing off the dinosaurs. So
I bought my little 1.5-year-old granddaughter a box full of little plastic insects.
Oh, yeah.
And she loves them. She's going to probably be an entomologist. I'm not sure, but I can't get them away from her now.
That's a good sign.
Everywhere. Well, as you look at this with scatter, adapt, and remember, is there an area, though, that concerns you the most about humans trying to survive a mass extinction, which could happen in our lifetime? We can't rule that out, can we?
Well, we can rule out a mass extinction happening in our lifetime because, like I said, generally, even the fastest of these mass extinctions took at least, 100 or 200,000 years. Because, again, remember how many species it has to be, 75% of them.
Okay, you mean even if, let's say, the 6-mile-wide asteroid hit tomorrow?
That's right.
It'll take that long to wipe everything out?
What'll happen is you'll have an initial kind of rain of death. let's put it that way. So say an asteroid hits. So in the immediate area around the asteroid, of course, you're going to have catastrophic death. You're going to have
wiped out.
Fires, you're going to have tidal waves, you're going to have earthquakes. It's going to be horrific. But the vast majority of the planet will not be affected by that immediate death ball. Unless we're hit by another planetary body, then I think all bets are off. But if we're hit with another, asteroid that's, the size of the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. So really what would happen is after that asteroid hit, there would be a period of basically nuclear winter. All the debris from that strike of the asteroid would go up into the stratosphere, and it would block the sun, and it would kill off plant life. And the worst part of it, and where I think a lot of the death would come in the immediate aftermath, would be starvation.
Yeah, I think you're right. And we think it's bad now for people. wait till something like this happens, Annalee. We're going to come back in a moment, talk more about your work, your great guest, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Plus, we flip the switch. We'll open up the phone lines. Jump on board with me on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're talking mass extinction with Annalee Newitz here, her books, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. Annalee, are governments setting up programs in the event of some kind of extinction? You know, I know they have the International Seed Bank, and, you know, somebody's smart enough to do that. But what is government doing collectively? Anything?
Well, it depends. I mean, certainly the UN has, you know, various committees that are dedicated to looking at space threats. And certainly in the United States, which is where I'm, what I'm most familiar with, the government has funded a program to track near-Earth objects, which are basically rocks that are floating through space in our planetary backyard, basically in possible intercept orbits with Earth. And they've had incredible success, in fact, in tracking thousands of these objects. And the reason why that's valuable is we were just talking about this fear about an asteroid hitting the planet. If we can be tracking those objects and being able to predict if one might be coming our way, we actually have a number of options for how to deflect them. And it's not just sending a nuke into space along with, you know, Bruce Willis, although that would be cool.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of other ways, especially because now with space-based telescopes, we can actually see these objects coming like 10 years out. And if they're that far away, you can actually just nudge them a little bit out of the way and kind of prevent them from hitting the planet. And so I think, I mean, that's a really important effort. And, you know, other space programs like the ESA in Europe are also working on similar things.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the problem today with asteroid hunting is that most of them that come by the planet, we see them after the fact. That's a little too late for me, huh?
Yeah, the one that hit or that exploded over Russia, there were a lot of reasons why we didn't see it. And luckily, it didn't turn out to be, you know, big enough to do, you know, horrible, lethal damage, mostly broke windows. But yeah, I mean, the hope is that we will be able to be tracking anything that's big enough to really do serious harm. And we're very, very close to that goal. So I think that, you know, that's something that we're pretty on top of. There's other kinds of threats like pandemics, which would affect, mm-hmm. you know, humans, not necessarily cause a mass extinction, but it might cause a human extinction that, you know, some government agencies and some international bodies like the World Health Organization do have, you know, fairly good ways to respond to, but we're still working on that. I think, I mean, one of the things that I really emphasize in my book is that we need to get into a mode as a global civilization to be preparing for this stuff, to be looking at the kinds of threats that we've had historically as a planet and thinking about how the hell will we respond if there's a mega volcano? Like, what would we do? I don't think we have a good enough response at this point. And I think planning for that and trying to create either government bodies or non-government bodies to handle that would actually be a really good step in the right direction for us, for humans as a group.
Sure would. Let's go to Kevin, Kansas City. Kevin's a first-time caller. Hi, Kevin. Thank you.
Good evening, George, and good evening to your guests as well.
Hi.
First-time caller. I love your show. My question is, I'm a huge science fiction kind of person, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on, like, these Fallout shelters, if anybody knows anything about the video game Fallout and their whole vault idea of underground living. Like that.
We talked a little bit about Turkey 1,000 years ago, but what about today, Annalee?
Well, actually, today there are a number of places where there are kind of the rudiments of underground cities. If you've ever been to Montreal or read about it, there's an enormous subway system under the city that's miles long or kilometers long, if we want to speak Canadian. And it's full of shops and, you know, it's an entire sort of underground space. And I think that living underground will become not just an option, but mandatory if we have some of these disasters we've been talking about. If there's a radiation disaster, we're absolutely going to have to be living in retrofitted mines and retrofitted subway tunnels. We're going to have to think about how to make those spaces livable. And that's a really interesting question. How do you make underground life something that doesn't drive you insane? And there are actually a lot of underground designers and architects who are thinking about it right now, and who are thinking about one of the really interesting things that I learned about underground living is that one of the biggest problems people have is that it looks, everything underground looks the same. And so if you want to design an underground city that's habitable, try to create neighborhoods, like create places that look really different from each other with like different kinds of brick and paint and different designs on the houses, and give people a sense of variety, and that really cuts down on claustrophobia.
And things for people to do. Can you imagine being underground for the rest of your life or for the foreseeable future and just existing?
Just playing Fallout all the time?
Yeah, absolutely. What about a biological, something concocted in a laboratory that gets loose and begins to wipe out mankind? Possible?
Sure, anything is possible. I mean, I think that's pretty low on my list of worries in terms of mass extinction, just because I don't think we're really, I think it's less likely than an actual wild-type pandemic, you know, an actual mutation that happens in the wild and flu or something like that. I think that's a lot more likely than a government-created pathogen or, a rogue actor's pathogen. So I think if we're going to worry about something, like, let's worry about, getting immunized so that we don't spread the flu during flu season.
Okay, back to the other calls. We have Christine in Merced, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Christine. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering what kind of evidence, if any, is there on survivors from Pompeii?
Evidence about survivors from Pompeii. I'm not sure we had any, did we, or did they all get wiped out? And Alija, did you ever research that?
Strangely enough, I have.
Perfect.
What was really interesting about Pompeii was that before the blast that actually did completely wipe out the city, and there were no survivors from that final blast, there actually had been a terrible earthquake and a small volcanic eruption about 10 or 15 years before that. And so a lot of people fled the city at that point and kind of left because they were sort of worried that there would be another disaster. And so at the time the city was destroyed, it was actually many parts of it were still empty and still kind of wrecked from the previous earthquake. And the other thing is that when the volcano did go off, it was kind of rumbling and making noise for a few days beforehand, so many people did have time to flee the city. So there were no survivors of the blast, but the people who thought ahead and said, maybe I shouldn't be here when this giant mountain is belching smoke, those people did survive. And so I think that's a great lesson in survival is, you know what, when the big mountain is smoking and there's earthquakes, don't stick around.
And Ali, when we see things, frogs coming out with, three legs, when bumblebees, honeybees are disappearing and dying off, are those telltale signs that something's afoot here?
There are one of the telltale signs that we may be entering a new sixth mass extinction is that we've seen a lot of die-offs among amphibians like frogs. And another sign is there have been die-offs among birds as well. So these are very worrying signs. And one of the statistics that's quite alarming is that if all of the creatures who are on the endangered species list now, so not creatures who are extinct now, but who are in danger of going extinct, if all of them go extinct, what we're looking at is actually a huge rise in species extinctions. And remember, to get that mass extinction, you need that 75% number, and we'd be inching a lot closer to that. And so that's why a lot of biologists are worried right now about these high levels of extinction.
Let's go east. Bill is in Charlotte, North Carolina, and now on Coast to Coast. Hello, Bill.
Hey, how's it going, George?
Okay.
Andy, I'd like to ask you a question. I do remember a story that was on one of the educational channels about a large caldera that exploded about 70,000 years ago in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And they say that genetically they can prove that there may have been only 20,000 people left on the planet after that because of the bottleneck in genetic material that is now accessible through mitochondrial DNA. Just how horrific this must have been to cause a climate change. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I am. What you're talking about is the Toba eruption. It was not a mega volcano on the scale of the one that happened, that set off a mass extinction about 250 million years ago, but it was quite large. There's a lot of scientific debate over whether that volcano caused, a near extinction event for humans. There's evidence that it may have cooled the climate down. And driven humans out of Africa, where they were mostly, Homo sapiens was mostly living in Africa at that time. And so, again, the debate is over, did the population really shrink down? Or the other possibility, which I find really interesting, is that it's possible that the population appeared small from a genetic perspective, because what people were doing was they were leaving Africa, and each time they would go further into, say, the Middle East or Asia, they would found a new community. And this is referred to by geneticists as a founder effect. And each time you found a new community, you get a smaller pool of genetic diversity, right? Because you have a big community, and so a smaller community goes off, they form a smaller one, less genetic diversity. They form a smaller community after that, less genetic diversity. And so as you're traveling out of Africa, you're getting a whole bunch of these founder effects where the group may be fairly large, but their genetic diversity is shrinking. And so once you have that happening over thousands of years and you get modern humans, it's possible that that shrinking that we see genetically was actually caused by all of these founder communities as people left Africa. So it may not have actually been that a whole bunch of people died off in a volcano. It may have been that actually it's a kind of a weird genetic artifact of this traveling that we did to leave Africa. So it's an open question. People are debating it, and definitely there's people who believe that, yeah, we were almost totally wiped out by a volcano, which is really scary.
When I was a kid, my science teacher told us the sun would burn out in about 5 billion years. And I got to tell you, I couldn't eat for a week.
Right.
Because to me, it was like it was going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I'd come home and tell my parents the sun's going to burn out. And my dad would say the same thing. George, that's going to be billions of years from now. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry, because in a billion years, the sun is going to get so hot that it's going to kill everything on Earth anyway. So no one will be around to see it burn out.
I'm going to ask you an interesting question before we take final calls here, Annalee. And that is, paint us the picture of when that happens and what will occur, whether there are humans on the planet or not. Kind of paint us this picture. As the sun begins,
eating the earth.
as the sun begins to go out and expand, it does what it does.
Before the sun, becomes smaller and cooler, it is going to go through a period where it expands and actually gets hotter. And at that point, at a certain point, it will be big enough and hot enough that the Earth will kind of resemble what Mars resembles now. It'll be kind of just a dead cinder. If you will. So the hope is that humans will have colonized many other parts of the galaxy at that point. And so we'll have good places to go with suns that are not misbehaving, and that we'll have a nice, rich galactic community to fall back on, so that we don't have to stay on Earth and watch the sun eat us.
Let's go to Doug in Gretna, Virginia. Hey, Doug, go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome, Doug.
Ma'am, I don't know if you've ever read the Bible or not, but if you'll read Genesis starting in chapter 6, you will see that there was a mass extinction on the planet of mankind.
Now, you're talking about Noah's flood, of course, right?
Absolutely.
All right, that's the one we didn't talk about. Annalee, not to get religious on you, but if the flood did occur, that may have been a mass extinction for that region. I don't think it was a planetary-wide thing. What do you think?
There's no evidence, at least from the perspective of science, that there was a kind of a flood that covered the planet. Although I will tell you about a pretty awesome and terrifying time in Earth's history, which is referred to as Snowball Earth. And it happened about a little over 2-3 billion years ago. And at that point, there was a global ice age. And ice actually covered the planet almost all the way down to the equator. And if you looked at the planet from space, it would just be this blinding white planet. And it was a time when actually life almost did die off on the planet. Only some microbes were able to survive. And actually, that is sort of the beginning of life on Earth, actually, after that. Once the ice kind of retreated, life was able to thrive. But there was a pretty terrifying time when we almost became ice world.
Let's go to Jane, Thatcher, Arizona. Squeeze you in here, Jane. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I wanted to ask, what do we do? We have all these big jet streams, and they are collectively flooding our Earth, and the aluminum in them is flammable, and we have the potential of these big volcanoes, but anything could set off when we get enough.
And what she's talking about, Annalee, of course, is the possibility of chemtrails from jets, not jet vapors, but chemtrails, of which a lot of people believe that, you know, things are being sprayed on mankind for who knows what purposes. But you're talking primarily about huge mass extinctions, are you not?
Yeah, I'm not talking about the extinction of humans, which of course is a very terrifying prospect, but actually much more than that. A mass extinction is when many, many species die out. And I think that humans have enough ingenuity and ability to learn from history that they will survive that kind of a mass extinction event. And so to me, what's really scary is the idea that we might not plan to survive. Like, we might decide, oh, humans are going to die out. And because we haven't made good plans, because we've been expecting to die out, we hit one of these mass extinction events, and we just don't have the ability to create a good life for ourselves. And we end up, you know, living in caves and eating fungus, which, you know, nothing wrong with eating fungus if you like it.
What a great dinner that'll be.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, it might not be nice for every night, you know?
That's a good point. That's a good point indeed. Well, the book is brilliant. Thank you so much. It's Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. Annalee Newitz, first-time guest here on Coast to Coast. She did a great job. Up next, UFOs, ETs, and alien abductions. Don Derry joins us on Coast to Coast AM.